Now, shall we begin?
A quarter century ago, November 15, 1991 to be precise, the future Secretary of Health and Human Services, Donna Shalala, who at the time was Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin, gave a speech at the University of Chicago, addressing a number of educators. Part of the speech was an extended peroration in which she imagined the ideal world of the near future, 2004, as seen through the eyes of a young girl named Renata, who was supposedly a typical four-year-old kindergarten student. Renata, according to Shalala, doesn't know any moms who don't work, but she knows lots of moms who are single. She knows some children who only live with their dads, and children who have two dads. This is 1991 once again. After her kindergarten class is over, Renata goes to a small daycare center operated by a neighbor who takes care of five children in her home. Notice, by the way, how peripheral Renata's own parents are to her experiences. That's a very important part of this scenario. The backyard of the home is a playground, which has been constructed with grant money from the city. Sometimes Renata and her best friend, Josh, play trucks. Sometimes they play mommy and daddy, and Josh always puts the baby to bed and changes the diapers, just like his own dad does at home. At Thanksgiving time, Renata's teacher would tell a story about how people from Europe came to the United States where the Indians lived, and that, of course, is a screaming anachronism. The United States didn't exist at the time. The teacher will say, "It was just the same as if someone had come into your yard and taken all your toys and told you they weren't yours anymore." I should interject at this point that I stipulate to the fact that Manifest Destiny was an exercise in unbridled ugliness. It was the creation of a continent-spanning superstate, which is a bad thing. It was carried out on the basis of an explicitly racialist doctrine of collectivism, in which the central government of the United States was seen as the embodiment of a divine mission to enthrone the Anglo-Saxon race as the dominant force on the planet. I stipulate to all of that. I do find it tremendously significant that Shalala's scenario here dealt with a classroom homily that focused on the iniquities of distant ancestors and the founders of a regime that had been overthrown and replaced with a different one that was just as bad, if not dramatically worse. If that weren't the case, perhaps the teacher, in order to illustrate in a tangible sense that theft is evil, would have distributed treats to every member of the classroom, then acting on a perfectly arbitrary basis, had taken more than half of the treats from some and given them to the others, and said, "This is social justice. Is taking from some of you who don't deserve what you have and giving it to specially protected people who are worthier recipients of this largesse." That's not the illustration that was used, and of course, there's a very good reason why this is so. To continue with Shalala's scenario, as the result of the indoctrination she would receive, Renata would be a true world citizen. She would think of herself as part of the world, not just her town or the United States. The more significant point here, of course, is that Renata doesn't think of herself as an individual. She doesn't think of herself as the member of a specific family, as the child of particular parents, a mother and a father, or as a sister to a certain group of siblings. She's part of an undifferentiated mass of humanity, being molded like clay by societal supervisors, of whom Shalala presumably would be representative. Shalala ended this speech by saying that the things she predicted would not simply happen, but they would come to pass because we made it our top priority in our communities and in Congress. And at the time, she was doing her formidable best as the Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin to help create this world that she anticipated by, among other things, imposing speech codes on campus. Yes, she was a PC pioneer, a pioneer of the art of political correctness. I must point out again that the term politically correct is not innocuous. The earliest recorded instance in which that expression was used was a memorandum sent by the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union to the offices of the Cheka in the near abroad, ordering them to annihilate the Don River Cossacks. This is the only politically correct solution, according to Lenin and his comrades, was the physical annihilation of people who are not assimilable into the new collectivist order. The speech codes imposed by Shalala banned the use of language that was seen as demeaning to any race, sex, religion, color, creed, disability, or other characteristics of that sort. She was one of the early campus pioneers of a hyper-egalitarian regime in which diversity essentially meant uniformity, at least in ideological terms. You're allowed to be phenotypically distinct, but you had to be ideologically conformist. Diversity likewise meant unanimity in rejecting tradition of any variety, not tradition which is imposed at the point of a bayonet, which is every bit as bad as revolution imposed at the point of a bayonet, but rather inherited traditions and values that were instilled in you by your parents or religious institutions to which your parents were affiliated. We are very much living in the world that Shalala had anticipated. Indeed, you could make a good case that we have leapfrogged Renata's world and wound up in something that was even more unsettling. About a year after Shalala gave that speech, one of my favorite television programs, Star Trek The Next Generation, broadcast an episode that in some ways, I think, embodied the threat, not the promise, but the threat of the ideology that Shalala was promoting, using this parable of four-year-old Renata. This episode was entitled The Outcast, and this was season 6 of this program, and by this point, it had become a little bit weary. This episode, which was written by Jerry Taylor, who would go on to co-create Star Trek Voyager, which was the least appealing of the Star Trek series, in my opinion, was a really good example of Star Trek in what I call after-school special mode. It was a progressive homily that was intended to convey a heavy-handed political message at fatal expense to entertainment value. This was Star Trek at its most didactic and its least engaging. The message was delivered with all the subtlety of a Gallagher stand-up routine. The introductory captain's log entry, which had been read in the mellifluous, low-baritone voice of Patrick Stewart, gives you an idea of what this story is going to be about. Captain's log, stardate 45614.6, we've been contacted by an androgynous race called the Genai to investigate the mysterious disappearance of one of their shuttlecraft. The transcription of this episode notes, the Genai are wearing loose-fitting one-piece suits and all have short hair. Indeed, they all look like variations on the theme of Mo Howard. The purpose of this episode was to try to get the audience to imagine what it would be like to live in a world without gender, a world in which people who expressed the instincts and characteristics of one or the other of the two quote-unquote genders would be treated the same way, supposedly, that homosexuals have been treated in American society. As one might expect, this was an episode that was completely devoid of nuance. Its entertainment value was nil, and great violence was done, in my opinion, to the characterizations of the main figures in this ensemble. It was intended to leave the audience mortified over the horrible things that were done to sexual minorities in the name of preserving tradition. But ironically enough, it serves today as a very good illustration of the dull, gray, cultural totalitarianism that is being imposed upon our society in the name of emancipating people from biology, from the distinctive characteristics that define two complementary halves of humanity, male and female. Every totalitarian order seeks the eradication of every impediment to the expansion of state power. The most formidable and most valuable impediment to the expansion of the state is the conventional family. This is something G.K. Chesterton talked about. He was somebody who had been a Fabian socialist. He knew how these people thought. He knew their ambitions. The family ultimately is the only human institution that regenerates itself naturally and thus impedes the ambitions of those who want total power over humanity. As C.S. Lewis pointed out, the ultimate ambition of those who crave totalitarian power is the abolition of man. That was the society described by Donna Shalala. Ironically enough, that Star Trek episode, which was intended to indoctrinate people about the supposed evils of traditional society, did a creditable job of depicting a society that had reached the end point of the process that C.S. Lewis described as the abolition of man, I'll have a great deal to say about this when I get back. This is Will Grigg with Freedom Zealot Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. Stand by for more sedition after this.
A critical rescue mission.
We've lost an engine.
Teams Riker with a mysterious outcast.
I find you attractive.
And leads to a forbidden affair.
Where is Soren?
In custody.
Now, a clash between two cultures.
Don't do this. Soren!
Forces Riker to sacrifice his career.
I can't just leave her there. They'll give her these psychotectic treatments.
I have to help her.
Next time on Star Trek The Next Generation.
For those of you who are not familiar with Star Trek The Next Generation, I need to introduce you to the character of William Thomas Riker, the first officer of the Federation flagship, the Starship Enterprise, under Captain Jean-Luc Picard. Born in Alaska, Riker was a tall man in his early 30s at the beginning of the series. I believe he was in his late 30s or even his 40s when the series wound to an end. He was bearded for most of the series run, and he was assertively masculine in a recognizable fashion to those of us who grew up in the United States in the late 20th, early 21st century. His taste in women generally ran to the voluptuous, yet, for the purposes of this story, this homily, called The Outcast in the sixth season, he found himself falling head over heels for an individual who was not recognizably female, completely in defiance of his established tastes and preferences. And that's the mark of bad melodrama, when you sacrifice characterization in order to make a point. Early in the episode, Riker, who had been assigned to work with a member of the species called the Genai, an androgynous race, in modifying a shuttlecraft, has the following conversation. The name of the character from the alien race is Soren. Riker said, "You handle these controls like you grew up in a shuttle," to which Soren replied, "I did. My parents were pilots. I was flying with them before I could walk, and as soon as I was old enough, I entered flight school. Krite, that's another member of the Genai race, was my instructor." Seeking to compliment Soren, Riker said, "He had a good student." "He?" Soren responded. "Commander, there are no he's or she's in a species without gender." That's a conversation that probably is taking place right now in a college dorm room or in a student assembly building, somewhere in the groves of American academe. "Okay," Riker said, somewhat nonplussed. "For 2 days I've been trying to construct sentences without personal pronouns. Now I give up. What should I use? It? To us, that's rude." Soren replies, "We use a pronoun which is neutral. I do not think there is really a translation." That seems to be eerily prophetic now, that we have seen self-styled scholars, in all apparent seriousness and sobriety, devise completely contrived pronouns such as "je," which are completely devoid of reference to either sex. Riker, seeking to be a gentleman, if I can use that expression without being hauled up on charges, said, "Then I'll just have to muddle through. So forgive me if a stray he or she slips by, okay?" The two of them repair to 10 forward, which is the recreational facility on the ship, to enjoy a bowl of split pea soup, which is something that Riker had grown up eating in Alaska. Riker said, "It's very healthy. It helps keep you warm on cold Alaskan nights." Soren said, "We prefer to stay warm by sleeping with a friend." To which Riker said, with a smirk playing on his features, "I see." Soren hastily adds, "Not to mate, just to sleep together for warmth." "Still sounds better than pea soup," Riker observed. "We are puzzling to you, aren't we?" Soren said. "A little. It's hard to grasp the idea of no gender." Soren, who once again could be a stand-in for a contemporary gender feminist, says, "It's just as hard for us to understand the strange division in your species, males and females. Let me ask you, what's it like on a planet where people have no gender?" "I'm afraid I don't understand," Soren responded. "Well, who leads when you dance?" if you dance. We do, Soren says, and whoever's taller leads. Without the Battle of the Sexes, you probably don't have as many arguments, Riker said. Just because we don't have gender doesn't mean we don't have conflicts. We're very strong-minded. We love a good fight. From the sound of it, Riker said, there's not that much difference between our species. A few scenes later, the two of them are involved in modifying the shuttlecraft, and Soren begins to ask more detailed questions about human physiology and about the anatomical differences between men and women, and about the complementary way that men and women are designed, and I will use the term designed, in order to bring about the propagation of the species. And then Soren comes out to Riker. I find you attractive, she said. I'm taking a terrible risk telling you that. It means revealing something to you, something that if were known on my planet would be very dangerous for me. Occasionally among my people, there are a few who are born different, who are throwbacks from the era when we all had gender. Think about that for just a second. This is the progressive conceit that at some point human beings will evolve beyond sex, meaning biological sex. This is a more advanced race because they no longer have what we're told to call gender, which is a term that's used dishonestly as a synonym for sex. She's a throwback to an era when we all had gender. Some have strong inclinations to maleness, and some have urges to be female. I am one of the latter. Riker says, I have to admit, I had a feeling that you were different. Soren replied, I was hoping you would, but in front of Krite and the others, I must be careful not to reveal myself. Why? Riker asks. On our world, these feelings are forbidden, Soren explains. Those who are discovered are shamed and ridiculed, and only by undergoing psychotectic therapy and having all elements of gender eliminated can they become accepted into society again. What she's describing sounds very much like what's going on once again on American college campuses. It's not psychotectic therapy, perhaps, that's being imposed upon people who insist on asserting the distinctiveness that characterizes the two complementary sexes. Those of us who have these urges live secret and guarded lives. We seek each other out, always hiding, always terrified of being discovered. How long have you known that you were like this? Soren replies, I've known I was different all my life, but I didn't understand how or why until I was older. I remember when I was very young, before I knew what I was, there was a rumor in my school that one of the students preferred a gender, in that case, male, Soren elaborates. The children started making fun of him, and every day they were more cruel. They could tell he was afraid, and somehow that seemed to encourage them. Notice how she's using gender-specific pronouns now. One morning in class, he appeared bleeding and in ripped clothes. He said he had fallen down, and of course the school authorities found out and took him away and gave him psychotectic treatments. When he came back, he stood in front of the whole school and told us how happy he was now that he had been cured. After that, I realized how dangerous it was to be different, and once I got older and I knew what I was terrified. I have had to live with that fear ever since. Predictably, and once again, at considerable expense to the integrity of these characters, this story progresses in such a fashion that Riker becomes romantically involved with this person who is completely incompatible with his established preferences as a man. She is found out, and she is hauled before a tribunal that charges her with sexual deviance, and she makes an impassioned plea for tolerance. I am tired of lies. I am female. I was born that way. I have had those feelings, those longings all of my life. It is not unnatural. I am not sick because I feel this way. I do not need to be helped. I do not need to be cured. What I need, and what all of those who are like me need, is your understanding and your compassion. She, of course, is hauled away to be cured through psychotectic treatments. Riker, who has inserted himself into this process, is ordered out of the tribunal. He has a conversation with Captain Picard in which he expresses a desire to interfere in the legal processes of this planet because, quote, my relationship with Soren is not trivial. She's very important to me. I suspect that that line was taken verbatim from the first outline of this script. In defiance of everything we know about this character, Riker is willing to sacrifice his career and perhaps even his personal freedom by violating the prime directive, the highest law of the Federation. The purpose of all this ultimately is to manipulate the audience into believing that conventional views of sex roles and the innate characteristics that distinguish the sexes are somehow just as cruel and just as retrograde as the punishment inflicted upon Soren because she identifies herself as a woman rather than being one of the gender-neutral beings that inhabit this androgynous planet. I'll be back in just a minute.
I am female. I was born that way. I have had those feelings, those longings, all of my life. It is not unnatural. I am not sick because I feel this way. I do not need to be helped. I do not need to be cured.
Says it's going to be difficult starting another school year on Tuesday where he knows he will be singled out. Why? Because he identifies as a boy and wants to be able to use the men's restroom. Earlier this summer, the ACLU filed a lawsuit on his behalf. This is all because the Gloucester County School Board passed a policy in December that had to do with Grimm. It said Grimm needed to use a bathroom that corresponds with the sex he was born with, or he can use a single-stall bathroom or the nurse's bathroom. Today, a federal judge in Norfolk denied Grimm's preliminary injunction to be able to use the men's room while waiting for a trial.
I was disappointed that I'm going to have to face another school year of discomfort and discrimination.
Gavin Grimm is a 16-year-old girl from Gloucester, Virginia. She believes that she is a 16-year-old boy. I suppose that she is entitled to that delusional self-definition. She needs help, but she should not be compelled to receive it. The problem is that in the service of her delusion, Grimm has enlisted the help of the local school district, and now the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, in trying to compel others to take part in her fantasy. That's something to which she is not entitled. And one has to ask the question why certain people who want to reconfigure society are so invested in the effort to make other people pretend that this biologically female 16-year-old is actually a male who experiences gender dysphoria, which is an emotional disturbance associated with the sense that you are, notwithstanding your biological sex, somebody who is of the opposite sex. Grimm registered as a female for her ninth grade year at the local high school. At some point during that year, and I suspect that Tumblr was involved in this process, she decided that she was actually a boy rather than a girl, notwithstanding her anatomical allotment. Her parents and the school administrators and counselors were all entirely supportive once she announced her intention to transition in a social sense, but not an anatomical sense. She would remain physically female, but she would now be recognized as male in essence, if not biology. The idea of a social transition is an interesting concept because this requires that people participate in your own personal melodrama. If you undergo a physical transformation where your genitalia are reconfigured to be those of the opposite sex, this affects you and presumably affects people who choose to associate with you. However, if you announce that you have socially transitioned from male to female or female to male, then you are requiring others to play along. And this obviously involves coercion, and it can involve deception. If, for instance, you present yourself as a female while you're actually a male, then you're potentially in a position to take advantage of people who are confused over the way that you presented yourself. And shortly I'll discuss one very interesting case here in Idaho that involves that type of deception, as well as aggravated sexual assault. After Grimm decided that she was a boy rather than a girl, her official records were changed to reflect this new self-identification, and a memo was dispatched to teachers in the school district ordering them to address her as if she were a he, and then requiring fellow students to do likewise. At no point in any of this did Gavin Grimm receive any type of pushback. At some considerable expense, the administrators of the school district accommodated her every whim. There were 3 unisex bathroom facilities that were established there at the high school to serve the needs of Gavin Grimm and anybody else who's experiencing this trendy diagnosis of gender dysphoria. And they were available as well to other people. I would assume that these are single-service facilities, and so there was no compromise of privacy involved. In order to avoid potential awkwardness in the locker room, Grimm was allowed to conduct PE classes at home. That, by the way, adumbrates the real solution to this problem, which is to abolish the government school monopoly. It was because of the fact that this is a government-run school that receives so much as a farthing, a federal subsidy, that the administrators were compelled to accommodate every wish, and those demands did become increasingly whimsical. Despite the outpouring of unqualified support she had received, she still felt stigmatized. Why is this? It's because she didn't have access to the boys' bathroom and locker facilities. She didn't need them. She still felt stigmatized, owing to their indoctrination in occurrent concepts of gender fluidity. Female students looked upon Grimm as if she were a boy. After all, they'd been told that they were to deal with her as if she were a he. Because of residual allegiance to reality, many male students still saw Grimm as a girl. And that created, of course, moments of unintended awkwardness that transcended the official indoctrination. So why was she not using the unisex facilities that had been provided for her? In her lawsuit, she complained that being required to use the unisex bathrooms was different and unequal treatment, which of course is true. She had been singled out as a member of a specially protected class for special entitlements that made her more than equal to the other students who did not have such an exotic self-definition. It is unwise and destructive to reinforce the delusions of an emotionally troubled adolescent girl. It is a species of madness to define public policy in congruence with those delusions. Nobody has the right to punish Gavin Grimm for her self-definition or to try to compel her to abandon that delusion. And on the same principle, neither she or any of the fanatic ideologues who are exploiting her as part of a project to reconfigure society has the right to compel others to participate in her fantasy. But that's the whole point, once again, of announcing a social transition. This is something you can't do by yourself. This is something that other people have to participate in. In writing about this, I've referred to this case as an exercise in participatory solipsism. Because Grimm, an accredited member of this specially protected class, defines herself in a certain way, hers is the only mental state that matters. And those who are not worthy of a similar designation must defer to her. It's not enough to make material accommodations, but people have to be compelled to think a certain way, or at least to pretend that they are thinking a certain way. Just a few days ago, the U.S. Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, in a 2-1 decision, demanded that the Gloucester School District permit Grimm to use the restroom facilities that were reserved for biological males, on the pretext that this is required under the infinitely expandable Title IX of the Federal Education Amendments of 1972. As the one rational judge on that panel pointed out, the text of that federal law forbids sex discrimination and defines the term sex as a biological attribute. That definition was altered not as the result of legislation or a judicial ruling, but rather through a letter that had been written to the school district by an unelected and unaccountable bureaucrat within the Department of Education, who simply said that for the purposes of policy, the terms gender and sex are interchangeable. Sex, once again, is a biological attribute. Gender, apparently, is a protean social artifact. On the basis of a letter that has no legal or constitutional standing, 2 judges in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals redefined the law in order to compel this school district to accommodate Gavin Grimm's desire that she have access to men's bathroom facilities in order to avoid the stigma of not being recognized as a fully functional male, in spite of the fact that she is a biological female. And even if she were to have herself mutilated in the service of her delusional self-image, she would remain genetically a female. Let us assume that the school district capitulates, as they have at every juncture in this controversy, and that they arrange for Gavin Grimm to have full access to men's only bathroom facilities. What happens when other male students decide not to be present when she is making use of said bathroom facilities? Will this not be stigmatizing behavior? Will this not impede her desire for a social transition? After all, this is something that has to be participatory. She cannot engage in a social transition all by herself. People have to be socialized in order to accept her new definition. So at this point, will the school resource officers that no doubt plague the halls of the high school be called upon to carry out a policy of compelled integration between the biological males and the self-identified transgender male? That's the logic, such as it is, of what the Fourth Circuit Court has ordained. And don't doubt for a second that this is something that we're going to see en route to the transformation of our society into the kind of soulless, dull, gray dystopia that was depicted in that Star Trek episode, which began as a parable regarding the supposed iniquity of those of us who admit certain politically unpalatable realities about the way that the two sexes were designed. I'll be back in just a minute.
Standing at the school board meeting last year was equal parts humiliating and terrifying. Humiliating because, at age 15, I had to witness adults of my community discuss in a public forum some rather intimate details of my anatomy. In plainer words, the anatomy of a 15-year-old was considered appropriate for public conversation by the Gloucester County School Board. For any kid, that would be mortifying. However, for a kid who is transgender, bringing to the forefront of people's minds the very part of themselves that already makes them dysphoric is incomparably distressing. I sat by while people repeatedly called me a girl. She, her, young lady, confused young lady, even freak. Bullying is already an enormous problem for high school-aged youth, and especially transgender youth.
Of course, it's been very hard. It's been very, exhausting at times and difficult as well. But I definitely think that the end has justified the means in this case, and it's very much been worth it.
So are you now allowed to use the boys' restroom?
We haven't really talked about the specifics with where that's concerned, so right now I'm not sure how that's being settled, but I haven't been back to school since the ruling anyway.
What do you think everyone is so afraid of?
The most important moral lesson that an individual can learn, and one is never too young to learn it, is that individual rights are a reciprocal proposition, which is to say that each of us has exactly the same allotment of rights as all the others do. This is the basis of the universal principle of morality called the Golden Rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Each of us, of course, needs no prompting in order to recognize the validity of our rights. The tricky part is recognizing that the rights of everybody else are equally valid. It's one of the reasons why I say that all rights are property rights, and all property rights are absolute. They have to be reconcilable. If you exercise a supposed right at the expense of other people, then what you're doing is not exercising a right. You're imposing yourself upon the others through aggression, through force, or fraud. This 16-year-old girl from Virginia who calls herself Gavin Grimm, I don't know what her birth name was, and professes to be a boy in spite of the fact that she remains a biological female, apparently never learned the golden rule or considers it to be of no value. And this is proven by a claim that is central to her lawsuit. She claims that she feels psychological distress when using girls' bathroom facilities in the presence of other biological females. I don't know whether or not this is true. It certainly wasn't true until a couple of years ago, when her Tumblr indoctrination finally took effect. Until then, she had no problem, or no unusual problems, in proceeding in that fashion when she needed to use the bathroom. She doesn't explain why it is that psychological distress is not alleviated by using a unisex bathroom. She did say that she feels stigmatized because she's using a unisex bathroom. So she wants not to feel stigmatized nor to feel psychologically distressed at the presence of other biological females. But she doesn't consider the fact that male students compelled to share bathrooms with her would certainly suffer psychological distress. Those of us who remember adolescence and the hormonal turbulence attendant thereto can understand that young males don't like to use the bathroom in the presence of other young males. They don't like to be in the locker room or the shower with other young males because of a sense of privacy and a sense of self-ownership. There are certain concessions that we make when we have to use public facilities or when we're involved in athletics or things of that kind. But given the fact that it's already a stressful circumstance for a teenage boy to use the bathroom in the presence of other biological males, it's not difficult to imagine how they would react at the presence of a biological female in the bathroom with them. So they certainly feel psychological distress. Isn't this something that Gavin Grimm should take into account? Under the golden rule, certainly. She doesn't want to feel distress. Therefore, she shouldn't be inflicting distress. However, she doesn't believe in the golden rule. She believes in Lenin's maxim that the key proposition is who does what to whom. She is the who. Those who are not part of the specially protected class to which she belongs are the whom. And the what doesn't matter. You see, under the golden rule, the what is the only thing that matters. The what has to be morally appropriate, and the who and the whom don't matter. I'd made mention of the fact that all rights are property rights, which brings us to the next question. What property right is being violated by not acceding to Gavin Grimm's demand to have access to restroom facilities and locker rooms being used by biological males? What property right would entitle her to be there? This is a question that was actually addressed in the dissent by Judge Paul Niemeyer, who may be the only judge in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals who has not taken permanent leave of his rational senses. In his dissent, Judge Niemeyer, who must have been writing with his teeth clenched in insuperable frustration, pointed out that an individual has a legitimate and important interest in bodily privacy such that his or her nude or partially nude body, genitalia, and other private parts are not exposed to persons of the opposite biological sex. This seems to be obvious. I believe it was G.K. Chesterton commending his rival H.G. Wells when Wells made some concession to reality, who said that sometimes it takes a great amount of courage to stand up in public and admit that 2 + 2 = 4. This is a 2 + 2 = 4 moment in this dissent regarding the risible ruling by the Fourth Circuit Court that a 16-year-old girl has a supposed right to inflict her presence in the bathroom upon biological males. He recognizes that there is an elemental property right, a form of self-ownership. That's what property begins with. There's an elemental property right to one's privacy and the integrity of one's body in compromising positions of this kind. Does Grimm have a property right entitling her to require others to see her as a boy and to be seen in such intimate quarters with biological males as they perform functions associated with the lavatory? What is that property right? I would reiterate that her claim is that she is socially transitioning, and in order to make a social transition as distinct from a biological transition, it is necessary to be validated by others. They have to ratify her self-image as a male, notwithstanding her anatomy. She's claiming that she has a property right regarding the perceptions and attitudes of others. And the state, the federal government, the Obama administration, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, insist that people in this school district in Virginia accept that claim In his dissent, Niemeyer pointed out that this unprecedented holding overrules custom, culture, and the very demands inherent in human nature for privacy and safety, which the separation of such facilities is designed to protect. More particularly, it also misconstrues the clear language of Title IX and its regulations. And finally, it reaches an unworkable and illogical result, and that is the ideal outcome for people who are driven by an insatiable appetite to reform what they see as defects in the way that others live and think. We're talking about a totalitarian mindset. Those who are possessed of a totalitarian mindset believe that all things, whether you're talking about custom and culture or the law, all things must yield to the imperatives of ideology. Their assumption is that we cannot manage our affairs without the constant invasive supervision of our enlightened betters, who have the means to punish us for behaving in ways that don't comport with their ideological blueprint, or even expressing opinions, dissenting opinions, that take issue with that blueprint. Gavin Grimm, as a 16-year-old girl, is under the irresistible influence of the thoroughly misbegotten idea that the world can accommodate her whims. This is something called the egocentric fallacy. The universe exists to service your desires. It's hardly surprising that a 16-year-old girl would be possessed of this idea, or that a 16-year-old boy would be captive to this notion. That's something that every adolescent succumbs to. Some of us never outgrow that phase. That mindset is a perfect match with ambitious people who believe that the powers of the state should be limitless, and that the world has to be remolded by force closer to their heart's desire. There is a huge and ever-expanding constellation of pressure groups who seek to expand the power of the state for the supposed benefit of some constituencies, and people of that description are using this troubled 16-year-old girl. Not because she's actually oppressed, because she isn't. Not because she's suffered a material injury, because she has not. And not because they want to expand human liberty, but rather because they see liberty as a zero-sum proposition between the who and the whom. They see themselves as the who, they see the rest of us as the whom. At some point, the 16-year-old, God willing, will become a 60-year-old. And I don't doubt that in the years between now and then, she'll have many occasions to reflect sorrowfully upon the fact that the state is not her friend and never has been her friend. It would be uncharacteristically wise of the cultural revolutionary left to consider this proposition. The powers that they are exercising right now at the expense of people they despise could very well be delegated to Donald Trump in January of next year. You see, these people assume that they will always be the who and never the whom. But the wheel never stops turning. Thank you for joining me this week on Freedom Zealot Radio. Please join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. I will be back with you again in a week. And until then, as always, dum spiro pugno, while I breathe, I fight. Good night, God bless, and may we send the state back to the hell that spawned it.
You still try to fight? Can't you see that it's hopeless?
That man won't quit as long as he can still draw a breath. None of my teammates will.